everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. If you want to learn more about their writers' conference, it's coming up in July, the 16th to the 19th at the SeaTac Hilton there in SeaTac, Washington. You can learn about it at pnwa.org. I know there's still slots available if you want to sign up. I should say that I'm going to be at the Chuckanut Writers' Conference in 2 weeks, 26th to the 27th or the 28th, excuse me, of June. Teaching there. I'll be giving a lecture. And so if you are going to the conference, stop by and say hello. And also, I just learned that I'm going to be teaching a one-day Craft and Confidence in Authors Masterclass. Write it down. It's July 11th. If you're in the Seattle area, particularly if you're in the Queen Anne Ballard area and you don't want to travel far, well, it's going to be held at the Tulinda Yoga Studio in Queen Anne. One day, Saturday, July 11th, from by 10 to 3. You can find out about it on my website, williamknauer.com. That's williamknauer.com. All right. So I am a story lover. I collect them in the Rolodex in my mind. I love stories. I amass them. I hoard them. And I particularly like stories about success and the strange way it comes to us. And one of my very favorite stories comes from today's guest, Mark Allen, author, musician, speaker, and it just so happens to be the publisher and president of New World Library. Now, I won't tell you the whole story. He told me this story the last time I had him on the show. So if you want to go back into archives and listen to it, you can hear him tell it much better than I do. But I will just tell you that at the time he decided to found New World Library, he was 30 years old. I don't think he had a job. He was an actor and a musician, not making much money, and he lived in a crappy little apartment in Oakland. And yet, from this place, he decided to start his own publishing company, and yet he knew so little about publishing, he had to go down to the corner store and ask the owner of the store how to start a business. But from that, he began New World Library, where he's gone on to publish many authors, including Shakti Gawain and one of my favorite writers and teachers, Mr. Eckhart Tolle. But that is not even the best part of the story. It is not. And I'm going to save the best part for him. I think we're going to begin our conversation there because it is what makes it so unique. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for that introduction.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It really, you know, I mean it when I tell you it's one of my favorite stories because I find it so instructive because you started from just the absolute dirt level, you know, in terms of your climb to where you are now. It's inspiring. And when I tell it to people, they often don't believe me, but I left out the best part of the story, which is where I'd like to start. Do you know what that part is, the way in which you decided to work when you did this, you started this venture?
Oh, sure, I get it, yeah. Yeah, it was the day I turned 30. I woke up in a state of shock. I realized I wasn't a kid anymore. I kept hearing this voice, "You're 30." Before that, it had been sort of cool to be broke, and I had no money. At the time, I had no job. I'd had a band that had fallen apart. I'd been in some theater companies that had fallen apart. I'd gotten kicked out of a Zen center, and I'd gotten fired as a busboy and dishwasher for being too slow. And I tried yard work for one day. This is not for me. This is way too much work for way too little money. And then I turned 30. I had no job, no money at all, no family support either. I was scrounging, a word we used all the time. I got to scrounge together another 30 bucks because my rent was $65 for this little slum apartment in Oakland a month. And that was my goal every month, to scrounge together 65 bucks. I'd play in some bars sometimes. Occasionally I'd get some tips and things. Right. But I had nothing happening. And pacing up and down that day, I remembered a little game we'd played during this Back to the Land experiment I tried in Oregon that had been a disaster in my early 20s. But we were sitting around the fire one night, and this couple said, let's play this game we played at church camp. Let's imagine 5 years had passed, and everything had gone as well as you could imagine. What would your life look like? And we went around the fire, and each person said what they said. I don't remember a word of what I said. I was like 22 at the time, so it had no impact in my life. But the day I turned 30, I remembered that, and I thought, this is a good idea. But this time, I'll do it in writing. And I took a sheet of paper, and this one sheet of paper really changed my life. When I look back on it, it's where I started to have some goals in life. I wrote ideal scene at the top, and I imagined 5 years had passed, so I was 35. Ancient. And everything, ancient, yeah, middle age. And everything right. had gone as well as I could imagine. Much to my surprise, what spilled out was I have a publishing company that's successful and profitable, publishing my books. I'd never written a book. And my music, I'd played all my life, but I'd never recorded anything.
Yeah.
And I have a big white home on the hill in Marin County, which is north of San Francisco, the most beautiful part of the Bay Area here.
Yeah.
And then as I thought about it, and I think this is what you're getting to.
This is the part I love.
When I dared, I mean, already doubts and fears were just coming. Overwhelming me, saying, way too much, Mark, way too
yeah.
much. But I put them aside. I said, wait, this is the game, to dare to dream my ideal. Well, my ideal, too, is I don't work too hard. I only work when I feel like it. I like musicians' hours and actors'
yeah.
hours, where you never do a thing before 1 in the afternoon, ever.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And as I thought of it, and I never liked Mondays. So I thought, okay, I want to build a successful company just working when I feel like it. So I that's what I started to do, and I built a successful company, and I usually put in about maybe 20 hours a week.
Yeah.
I start Tuesday afternoon between 1 and 2, and then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday afternoon, I'm here. I want to be here at the office.
Right.
And then Friday, sometimes I take off or record or something. And then I always take Monday off and weekends off.
This,
and that's been my dream.
This.
And my doubts and fears said, it won't work. You must work hard. I had the same right. conditioning we all have. You've got to
sure.
work, you know, 40 hours a week, 50, 60 when you start your own
sure.
company, I was told, you know. But I looked
right.
at that. I said, why do we believe that? That's not necessarily true.
That's
it just
right.
becomes true in our experience if we believe it. So I decided to challenge it. I said, I want to work musician's hours. I want to start at 1 or 2. I want to sleep in. I usually sleep till 11 or so.
You'd still?
And then, yeah, still.
Oh, my God. I haven't slept till I can't do it if I tried. Okay, so you sleep till 11.
Yeah, between 10 and 11. Like this morning, I woke up. It was like 9:30, and I thought, that's too early. So I went back to bed.
Oh, this is fantastic. You know, I decided this story is, Mark, this story is the Jonathan Livingston Seagull of business success stories. Because, are you familiar with that? You must be familiar with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so I love that book, yeah.
Do you know Richard Bach? Have you met Richard?
No, I never met him. But
oh, he's a great guy. He's still around, still writing.
Good.
He, you know, that book had no business based on what we think of as a publishable, successful book being successful. It was tiny. It's 10,000
right.
words. It's got pictures
strange.
Of a seagull. It's a weird
right.
little book, and it sold 44 million copies. And I would say the same thing. I mean, based on our model, your idea had no business working.
Right.
You know, based on the model, based
yeah.
on the reality.
And my own thoughts, I'd say 95% of my thoughts were convinced it wouldn't work. But I managed to get. I'd heard. Fortunately, somebody had told me about Buckminster Fuller, who said when he was in his 20s, he decided to either commit suicide or look at his life as this unique experiment. And fortunately, he chose the experiment. I just latched onto that word experiment on my 30th birthday, and literally said to my doubts and fears, "I want to try this as an experiment." They said it won't work. I said, "Yeah, but I won't be any worse off than I am now."
Right. Right.
I had no money, no job. And even my doubts and fears, I had to say, well, yeah, that's true. You know, how much lower can you go financially?
You got zero.
You know what it reminds me of, Mark? When I teach people, a lot of writers I teach, their number one concern, one of their biggest concerns is time. I don't have enough time because most of them have jobs and families and blah, blah, blah. And what I've come and one of the first people I think of when I think about time is your pal, Eckhart Tolle. And I think about when he all the time he spent sitting on that bench where he suddenly realized he had the time to do that. And don't you think time, the way we spend our time, is a reflection of what we have decided is important?
Exactly. It's based on our beliefs that we have chosen. We've chosen a bunch of beliefs, usually subconsciously, about time.
Yeah.
And they become true in our experience, but they're not necessarily true. I have a lot of time. I have a lot of time. So does Eckhart. He admits he's lazy, too. We hang out sometimes and do very little.
But you see,
in a whole day, we might talk about his new imprint or something for half an hour.
Right. But that's it. But see, I think that the whole idea of laziness, I just got the last fellow I interviewed was Richard Thaler, who's an economist. And his best friend, who happens to be a Nobel Prize winning economist, said to him, "Your best trait is laziness," by which he meant you only do things that you're interested in. That was his definition of laziness. And that was Richard's greatest strength. Like, he wasn't going to do it unless he was interested. And so in his mind, it was a kind, you know, even in Richard's mind, it was almost like laziness because he simply wouldn't pursue it unless he cared about it.
That was exactly my experiment, to do what I loved when I loved it in the moment and not to do the things I didn't love.
Yeah. God. You know, my curse, Mark, growing up, was I was good at being good at things. Which I know sounds like bragging, but it's not, because what happens is I really wanted to be successful. I mean, it was like life and death I wanted to be successful. And the problem was I could be kind of good at anything. It's a kind of skill. And it took me years to realize you have to decide what you want to be good at. Choose.
Yes. Yes.
It's not enough to simply be good at any old thing you put your attention on.
Right.
My wife can't do that. She's the opposite. She can only be good at something, quote unquote, if she loves it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
That makes total sense. I was just born knowing it was important to do what I loved.
Yeah.
And I think because I had two older brothers, the oldest did what the parents wanted him to do. He studied business. You know, he was the perfect son. He was the parents' dream. But he wasn't passionate about working for a big corporation. He was passionate about golf and fishing. He should have been a golf pro or a fishing guide. But then my other older brother came along, the number two, and he was the total rebel. He totally fought my parents.
Yeah.
And I got real young. Oh, you can't do what your parents want. You have to do what you want. But it doesn't do any good to fight them either, because when you rebel against something, you empower it. So I just I did my thing. I just knew it was important to do what I loved. And that served me very well over the years.
Yeah, I think we talked about this last time, but I find myself when I'm teaching that's one of the main things I have to teach people is that it's okay to just do what you love. There's such a narrative about like that. You get to do that once you're done working. You know, once you're done with all the chores and all the work, then you can have fun and then you can enjoy yourself. But to work creatively, it's a pursuit of pleasure. I mean, true is a pursuit of pleasure.
Yeah, and just don't postpone your creative thing feeling you have work to do. A woman in one of my workshops once said she always dreamed of writing poetry, but she felt she had to have her house impeccably clean and even her closets organized first.
Oh, God.
So she never, here she was, you know, 50-something, had never written anything. And I just said, tonight, go write a poem. What does it matter how clean your closets are? When you die, is that what friends are going to say at your funeral? Oh, her closets were just impeccable. She went home that night and wrote a poem. She was, you know.
But do you see what we do to in our mind? Isn't it amazing the rules we can create? We can make up any cockamamie rule to keep us from doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's astounding.
Yeah.
Now, all right, so Tantra for the West is your latest offering, and a lot of my listeners are probably familiar with tantric this and that, only from sex, but they're familiar with the term tantric sex, but tantra is a philosophy, is a way of thinking that comes from Eastern philosophy. Can you sum it up a bit for us?
It's quite fascinating to me where if you say tantra or tantra in America, people think sex. Oh, you mean sex with some mysticism thrown in. It's kind of fascinating. I guess maybe we are obsessed with sex in our culture. I don't know. But that's the way it is. But if you go to study tantra, like I studied Tibetan Buddhism for almost 3.5 years at a Tibetan center here in Berkeley, and they call it tantric Buddhism. It's the path of tantra. And you go in the East, and it's very different. And I grappled for years, first of all, learning what they meant by Tibetan tantra, and then how can I adapt that to my life in America? And I spent years really grappling with this, and a book came out of it, Tantra for the West. What I finally got, what I learned about from that Tibetan center was, in fact, it was in a story that it all dawned on me. He told a story. He said, there's really three paths of traditional Buddhism. He came out of the traditional Tibetan Buddhism, and he very much wanted us to embrace the traditional Buddhism. I really tried it for 3.5 years full-time, and then found, no, I had to go away from the traditions, but find what in there works for me. He says there's three different types of people on the path. He said the path is up the mountain to enlightenment or awakening, and across the path grows patches of poison. In the Tibetan language, poison and negative emotions, anger, fear, greed, are all the same word. So there's poison growing across our path. He said the monk or the nun comes up the path, sees the poison, and immediately goes the other way. Away from the poison, up another path. And he said that's a perfectly fine path, and that's the path of the monk or nun. He said the path then of the bodhisattva, the awakening being, is to come up, see the poison, and plow right through the poison and plow right up to the top of the mountain of awakening. And that's a great path. The path of the tantric yogi, the path of tantra, you come up the path and see the poison, and you go directly into the center of the poison. And when he said that, it took me a while. I had to reflect on it. I had to wander around. Even though it apparently takes you off your path, you go into the center of that poison. That's the path. So what he really meant is, oh, whatever feeling comes up, if anger comes up, if jealousy, if fear, you go into the center of that. That's your spiritual path. And then after a while, it dawned on me what they're talking about is then the path of every moment of your life. He kept calling it a direct path, direct path. It's direct because you're on it 24/7. Whatever is happening in your life is your spiritual path.
It makes sense that you're such good friends with Eckhart Tolle because, of course, you know, I listen and read a lot of spiritual teachers, and in my mind, everyone's talking about the same thing from a different point of view. We're all taking all these different roads to the same place, and Eckhart Tolle's portal is the present moment. You know, that seems to me his genius that he found that, and that's what you're talking about is saying, look, all of life is right here, right now. It's not coming. It's everything is in this very moment. You have it all right here. But so go into this moment.
Right.
Is that a fair?
Right. Yes. And especially if in this moment there's anxiety or frustration or anger, jealousy, if there's a so-called negative emotion, get into that.
How do you get into it? Give me an example of getting into it.
Yeah, the first exercise in the book is totally simple, and it's totally transformative. It led me to write the phrase, even in our darkest moments, our brightest treasures are found. In our darkest moments. Our brightest treasure. Whenever anxiety comes up, Eckhart experienced deep, deep fear that he was suicidally fearful and panicking. That was the depth of his emotion he went into. And as he went deeply into it, he felt this voice in his chest saying, resist nothing. That was his breakthrough. And yes, he is a genius, and his genius is he didn't forget it. We've all had these moments of absolute awakening, but we tend to forget it. So we need to remember. Most of us need to remember. Yeah. So the first exercise in the book is just whatever feeling's coming up for you, you just sit there. You go off alone and you say, what am I feeling right now? And you find the answer. And you say thank you to the voice that answers that. And even, what am I telling myself right now? You acknowledge every thought that's going through you. Oh, I'm telling myself, this is really frustrating because that person just doesn't get it. Whatever it is, then you say thank you. And you keep looking at that emotion. You open the door. Our deepest fears, and it's all based on fear. All of our so-called negative emotions all have fear at their roots. Yeah. The Course in Miracles is exactly right about that. There's two basic emotions, fear and love. All our fears continue to be so strong because we don't want to look at them. We want to avoid them. We want the path of that nun or monk that avoids. But the path of Tantra, no, you get in the middle. You plunge right into your fear. You say, what is going on? Why am I fearful? And you get an answer. Then you say, what's the worst possible thing that could happen? And you play out that story. And an amazing thing happens. Your fears actually lighten up. Your depression lightens up. I even knew a guy that did it with headaches. When you have a headache, he would have people sit there and close their eyes and describe their headache, the shape of their headache, where it was located. Does it have a color? What does it feel like? And as they focus on it, it starts to shift and change, and it gets less intense because they're not resisting it, saying, oh, God, I have a headache.
Right,
I don't want this headache. Instead, they're saying, what is this headache? What is it? He called it consciousness focusing. You focus your consciousness on it, and if it's a pain or a fear, it will lessen. It will lighten up.
When I get sick, I learn to start asking myself, what does the sickness feel like? Like, what is the what's the story of the sickness, even if it's like a cold?
Yes.
And it always has a story to it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't do it right away. It's not just think, oh, I'm sick. Doesn't this suck? But then I start asking myself, what is it saying? What is it saying?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember the moment I did that in the dentist chair. As a kid, I had a lot of painful dentistry. And then I remember one time years ago, I was sitting there, I don't like this. And I realized, I'm resisting the pain. The problem is not the pain itself, but my resistance to it. And I said, what's going on here? And I just shifted. I just felt it. And, it feels like electricity through your whole body and mind.
Yeah.
And it's not even all that painful. It just, it's intense, but it passes quickly.
Yeah. Consciousness and not resistance. You know, when I write, I've come to understand that writing, you had said about remembering, you mentioned that Eckhart Tolle thought to resist nothing and then remembered to continue to do that. And I made this, see if this makes sense to you. I made this decision as a writer years ago, and this really changed it for me, that writing, there were times when I wrote where it was effortless. And I had believed the story that was luck. You know, the muse visited me today. And then somewhere along the line, I said, what if it's not luck? What if I could actually, you know, aim my creative arrow towards effortlessness and make that be the norm? And it did. It became the norm. It became the norm. But I had to choose to say, that's what I think it should be. As opposed to just, well, that happened. God knows why. Let's hope. Who knows what's going to happen tomorrow?
Right,
I made it
right.
the thing I was aiming for, and it became pretty much the norm, and to the point where it is now.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to decide that's what you want.
Right.
You know, if you have that moment of where you give up resistance, if you become conscious of it, then you can choose it the next time, as opposed to just waiting until events kind of force your hand.
Right.
Doing it on purpose.
Yes.
Doing it on
that purpose. Word luck is very interesting. I mean, people, as I've succeeded, some people have said, I'm lucky. And I say, I heard a brilliant person once say that luck is preparedness meeting opportunity. You get prepared, and then you suddenly become aware of opportunities. So you create your own luck.
Of course.
So by making your goal in that, even specifically in writing, you were preparing. You were preparing to take it up a level. It puts you in control rather than some kind of forces beyond us.
But you have to believe you can have that level of... You have to know what your role is, what you have control over, you know, and what you don't. You have control over whether you resist or not.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
We do. We even have control over our own thoughts and feelings, ultimately. But at first, it doesn't feel like it.
No.
I remember when I started all this meditation and stuff, I felt like I was on this emotional roller coaster that was beyond my control. And I had all these thoughts that were totally beyond my control. But after doing some meditation for a while, I realized, we can totally control our thoughts. We can change our thoughts. And the second chapter of Tantra for the West is all about affirmations, because I think one of the main greatest teachings that I got from the East had to do with their mantra, their chanting, their repeating, just the same thought over and over. Well, I needed to adapt it for the West and just came up with affirmations. Oh, when you're thinking something, you can think the opposite. You can affirm something else. When I have trouble in my marriage, for instance, I will just let that go. And I affirm to myself that my marriage and family life is filled with grace, ease, and lightness. That's my affirmation. Right. And I sit there and I say, I'm filled with grace, ease, and lightness in this situation. And it does absolutely transform the situation.
And you have to do it despite seeing evidence for the contrary. Because usually it's in the face of what you perceive as evidence saying, no, there's nothing graceful or easy about it.
Right. Right. I heard some person say, our subconscious mind is like a 5-year-old child in a way, but a very powerful one. But it'll believe whatever we tell it. And so if we keep saying to our subconscious mind, oh, life is hard, or oh, this marriage really has problems, or this is frustrating, our subconscious minds will say yes, yes. But then if we flip it right around, if we tell our subconscious, every moment of my life I'm filled with grace, ease, and lightness, our subconscious says yes, yes. And suddenly we're filled with grace, ease, and lightness. It's very powerful. But we affirm.
Yeah, what do you want to live? You know, what do you want to live? Yeah. And also, like, what when you're thinking something like, this marriage is hard, one of the things I've had to start, I mean, I learned it from writing, of course, where I only know if I've written the right sentence, or what I feel is the right sentence, if it feels right, if it feels effortless, if it feels natural, if it feels inspired. And so if I'm going along and I think, my wife doesn't care about me, she's just trying to undermine me, if that doesn't feel good to think it, that means that what I take that to mean is that that thought is out of alignment with the truth. It's out of alignment with the way I want to live. And I have to question it, no matter the evidence to the contrary. Questioning it doesn't feel good.
Yes, yes.
Right?
That's totally on the path of Tantra, if you want to look at it. It's the path of using every thought, every emotion is part of our growth.
Yeah. Everything. Mark, I tell you, I could talk to you for hours. I love talking to you. I'm thrilled to have you on the show, but all things must end. And so I'm going to ask you, though, one final question. I can't remember if I asked you this last time, but you know, it doesn't matter because answers change anyway. So what I'd like you to do is think about this. If writing has taught me anything, finish this sentence. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what?
If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me to look at every moment of my life as my path, and it's helped me get very clear on every moment. The kind of books I write, I have to completely live first. And that's why in Tantra for the West, there's chapters on relationships, sex, being alone, work, money, creativity, food and drink, meditation and yoga, aging and healing, politics, enlightenment, daily life, and freedom. Those are the main chapters. And each one of those I've had to reflect on and make sure that it's part of my life. I remember my Tibetan teacher, one of the first things he ever said was, first we just hear all this information, and we need to be open and take it in. Then we see how that operates in our lives, and that's where information becomes knowledge, when we really live it. And then we act, and then that knowledge becomes wisdom. So I want to write from wisdom and understanding, and I think a whole lot of writers can get things intellectually at first, information, and get the right language, but they're not living it. They don't really have knowledge or wisdom, but they can write a good story or write a good book. And that's wonderful in writing fiction. Yeah, make up a good story. I love good fiction. And it doesn't matter if the fiction writer's life is a total mess. It doesn't matter.
No. What many of them are.
Many of them are. And it's the story that matters, of course. But in nonfiction, if you're writing books that you want to help people, and help change people's lives and help change the world, which is the focus of our company, first you have to change yourself and make sure that every word is absolutely honest.
Yeah. I agree 100%, Mark, 100%. You got to live it. Abraham Hicks says, she said, words don't teach, although she offers words. She says, experience is your teacher. I mean, the words give you a direction, but it's the experience. It's the experience. It's the experience that is going to actually teach you. You have to live it. Well, Mark, it's been great chatting with you. I hope we get to do so again. Best of luck with this and all you've got coming out. The best way to find it is to go to you. If someone wants to learn about you and all that you do, what's the best place? Where should they go?
There's markallen.com, markallen.com. And my company is newworldlibrary.com.
New World Library. Excellent. All right, Mark. Well, listen, thanks again and have a fabulous rest of your day.
You too, Bill. Thank you for everything.
All right, you're welcome. You got to live it, people. It's true. He's right about that. I've certainly learned that as I've moved from fiction into nonfiction. It is the living first that is what's necessary. Well, next week I'll be talking to Sunita Patini. Can't wait to talk to her. Haven't met her yet. Until then, go out and just be a little lazy like Mark and me. I got to admit, I'm a little lazy too. You may not know it, but it's true. Go out and be a little lazy and just do something you love for no other reason than you love it. See what happens.